Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Carl Agnew, who is a founding partner with Gerstein Agnew. He has conducted research for hundreds of political campaigns, including directing national research and message developments for the Gore-Lieberman campaign. He serves as senior advisor to Democracy Corps, a nonprofit advocacy group he helped found in 1999 with James Carville, Stan Greenberg, and Bob Shrum. Welcome to Background Briefing, Carl Agnew.
Thank you very much.
And he's your colleague, James Carville, has been quite critical of this after these speeches of both the president and Boehner on CNN. He felt that for some time now, he called it a rout, that the president's been smoked by the Republicans. Are you that pessimistic about things? I take it, like me, you don't want to see this presidency fail.
Certainly don't want to see it fail, and I think I'm not quite as negative as James, but I think the whole conversation, the whole tenor of this debate, you know, is so lopsided and so one-sided, and I think in a way that ignores what got us to this point. That ignores the spending decisions and the tax decisions that were made that brought us to the deficit situation that we're in now, and that the solutions that are being discussed don't really reflect the problems that got us here in the first place. So I think there's a lot of frustration there, you know, not just myself and James, but progressives across the board.
But doesn't that, to some extent, point the finger at the press? Because first of all, the press gave equal time to both the president and Boehner last night, and that's the way it's been discussed. But it's not an equal argument. One side is threatening to destroy the full faith and credit of the United States if they don't get 100% of their way. I mean, the other, it's an outrageous imbalance.
There was a really striking piece in the Washington Post today talking to House Republicans about where we go from here. And it's really striking that they don't really see that there's a choice. It's just their entire worldview. There's our way, which is the right way, and there is no other choice. So we passed our bill. We passed our completely delusional balanced budget amendment, which has no particulars and has no reality and no chance of ever being signed into law. We passed it, and now we're just going to sit here and watch everything fall apart. There's no interest in negotiating. There's no conception that there might be another way or a give and take. It's not even in their worldview. It's really striking.
So do you think the president should have, as apparently many critics on the Democratic side who are frustrated with the situation and obviously quite alarmed at it, and I think we all should be because it seems to be somewhat out of control. The ship of state seems to be heading for the abyss here. Do you think he should have come out with the speech weeks ago or perhaps a month ago and generated the kind of calls that they got that almost crashed the phone service in the Capitol?
Yeah. In terms of the timing, I'm not sure. I mean, I know the president's tried to negotiate. There have been fits and starts, and I think that in a lot of ways he's frustrated with what he's dealing with because it's such a slippery target. You know, I'm certain that if the president had gone to the House Republicans, and not saying that he ever would have, but just hypothetically, if he had gone to them 2 months ago and said, yes, we agree to all of your demands, every single stipulation you put forth, we agree to it, they would have just moved the goalposts further. There is no fixed target that you're negotiating with. And so I think this president's instincts are always to be the conciliator, to be, as the press keeps saying, the adult in the room, and to try to reach some kind of a middle point. And I think he's just been frustrated in not having a partner to conduct those negotiations with.
Well, I hope that's a winning strategy. I'm aware of the expression in this country that nice guys finish last. So tell me, as a political strategist, Carl Agnew, is winning the center mutually exclusive with losing the left?
I don't believe so. The left, the center, in all the public polls, and it's really striking how consistent the polls have been, no matter how you ask the questions. You know, often you see conservative slanted organizations ask questions one way to produce one result. More progressive organizations ask them in another way, produce another result. Every poll across the board shows that the overwhelming majority of Americans want to see a combination of spending cuts and tax increases, closing loopholes, common sense decisions that bring us to a middle point. They want to see both sides give on this, and it's not even a question what they want. And so there is political pressure to be exerted on Republicans, but they've played this game, and it's been allowed to progress to this late point where Now, as you said, the full faith and credit of the United States is in the balance, but there is tremendous political pressure to be paid and a political price to be paid by those who are pushing us to that point. And the polls also suggest that people hold Republicans in Congress much more responsible for this and see them as much less willing to compromise. So there is a political price for them to be paid, and I do think that they will buckle when Social Security checks are not being cut, when veterans are not being paid, when federal prisons are letting prisoners out the doors. I mean, those are the kind of consequences that we're talking about post-August 2nd. When those things start happening, I think a lot of the Republicans who are ignoring the reality of what the post-August 2nd period looks like will quickly discover a new religion.
Again, I'm speaking with Carl Agnew, who's a founding partner with Gerstein Agnew and a senior advisor to Democracy Corps. But in terms of calling the bluff on this this extortion that's going on by the Republicans and apparently by the Tea Party wing, because it's not even clear that Boehner's bill is going to pass. It looks like the Tea Party are going to scuttle it. But if the president were to call their bluff, the problem there is that it would be a Pyrrhic victory, surely, the fellow that was running for president there for a while, Donald Trump, said on Fox News, rather gleefully, I'm afraid, he said, oh, well, you know, he wants to destroy Obama's presidency. And he said that, you know, go ahead, bring the House down. The Republicans will get blamed for it in the short term, but by election time, Obama will be left with the wreckage and he'll go down.
As we started this conversation, it's kind of the framework that's been accepted in this debate, but there's a lot of other possibilities that are out here. Former President Clinton has advocated the fact that the president should rely upon the 14th Amendment and his responsibility here to ensure the full faith and credit of the United States and basically ignore what Congress is doing right now. A fact that I'm struck at how little is discussed is the fact that this Congress passed the budget. Right? Remember the long debate that we had over it, the full fight that was had over the budget. They passed a budget. They are now refusing to fund the budget that they passed. It's almost like constitutional double jeopardy here, that they're going back and relitigating legislation that they've already passed by refusing to fund a budget that they have already gone ahead and passed. So, you know, the president does have those options.
But Carl Agnew, surely, I mean, I don't, I'm not a constitutional lawyer like the president, but if he goes ahead and uses the provision in the 14th Amendment that it goes back to obviously the post-Civil War era, it becomes law, I guess, and then it's challenged, right?
Absolutely. And I think that we're looking at a series of very unfavorable circumstances here. But if the choices are to stop paying Social Security, to stop paying soldiers in the field, to stop paying veterans, or to use, you know, his responsibilities as president to face up to the responsibilities and to do right by this country, I think it's a choice that can be made, and it's a fight that we should be willing to have.
And how quickly do you think it will get to the Supreme Court? Because the Supreme Court is fairly conservative, as you're well aware.
Absolutely. And again, we're in uncharted waters at that point. I don't have the legal expertise to tell you that. But I also think that it sends a powerful message to this president and those who agree with his position in this fight.
So as a strategist then, Carl Agnew, you don't feel we're in a worse situation. I mean, the analogy, when Carville made those remarks, it felt to me like a de facto way of saying that under Clinton, when they had a similar situation, they strategized in a way that ended up with Clinton coming out on top and Gingrich basically going too far. You can't equate that, can you? Because it's one thing to shut down the government temporarily; it's another thing to destroy the economy.
It is. It absolutely is. The stakes are higher here, but in that fight, they did position the president well, and they did dare the Republicans to take the ultimate step, which in that one was shutting down the government, and the Republicans chose to take the ultimate step rather than compromise and reach an agreement. We're in the same position here, only the stakes are higher.
But you have a different president in the sense that this president is a conciliator. He's reached out to them. I think he genuinely believes in bipartisanship. And I spoke to people that put on seminars at Harvard, that he attended, these long weekend seminars where Ralph Reed would sit down with Andy Stern or somebody, that kind of mixture. And he said the president really is in, really enjoys that kind of give and take. So it seems like he's already committed himself to the path that he's on. I don't think he's going to pull that kind of ultimatum, is he?
It's certainly not his it's not his natural position. I certainly don't think it's the path that he wants to take. But as we get closer and closer to August 2nd, everyone faces a dwindling set of options that are increasingly unpleasant.
I see. Well, do you think then that his strategy, if indeed it is his strategy, and that's what you mentioned earlier, the press keep referring to being the adult in the room, that he is going to win over the center, and that I don't know what the polling suggests here, but I've already asked you the question whether winning over the center will mean that you lose the left. And a lot of people argue that the worst thing that could happen is that the Republicans suddenly wake up and behave with some sanity and accept these deals that we told were being offered. And if that were true, a lot of the sort of legacy of the New Deal would be up for grab. At least that's what we were told about what's been going on. We don't know the exact details, but do you accept that notion that maybe it's better that the stuff that was on the table was rejected and is now off the table?
It's very difficult to know what's really on and off the table. You know, members of Congress with whom I've spoken really don't know. You know, I think anyone who isn't in the room as these multiple levels of negotiations are going on, they'll really know exactly what's on and off the table. So it's difficult to speculate. But certainly a lot of what we've seen in the press is disheartening in terms of the imbalance that's being discussed. And we have to see how permanent this deal is as well. You know, what ultimately gets decided, whether it's large, whether it's small, whatever it is going to, I think, be relitigated in the 2012 elections.
And given the nature of the way that the president ultimately laid out his argument, which essentially I think came down to the notion, and I think it's a pretty clear fact that the Republicans are extorting this kind of situation in order to get everything they want, largely at the behest of millionaires and billionaires, and to whom they are being thoroughly faithful. And the president went on to point out that, you know, hedge fund managers proportionally pay less tax than their secretaries. It's time for the people who've done so well over the last few decades to pony up. And you only have to go back to the Clinton era to see that when everybody paid their fair share of taxes, instead of the economy crashing, it boomed.
Absolutely. And I mean, go back to the discussions that were being had a month ago that, again, have been completely obscured here. But what is it that the Democrats were asking for? They were not asking for tax increases on people who make $50,000 a year. They were asking to close the loopholes for oil companies and corporate jet deductions. I mean, these are not outrageous requests. These are not, you know, really galling ones and ones that put a disproportionate burden on Americans across the border would hurt the economy in any real way. Of course, Republicans reflexively say that this would hurt mom-and-pop businesses. You know, it doesn't matter what tax you discuss. That's their automatic response no matter what. But the taxes that we were talking about, the balance that was trying to be introduced into the deal, is really striking in how modest the efforts were.
Well, but I guess just in closing then, Carl Agnew, I'd like to get a sense of from polling where we stand in this country in terms of whether we have become sort of vicarious, like in the 1930s, during the Depression, they made all those movies about rich people, you know, whether we're all sort of, you know, have this aspirational politics where one day we'll win the lottery and we'll become millionaires and billionaires, just like Donald Trump, although I think he's a phony in that regard as well. But the long and the short of it is there still a sense of fairness? Is there some outrage over there? Out there about the growing disparity in wealth in this country, the idea that the middle class and the working people in this country are bearing the brunt, that the wealthy are having an enormous free ride. Is there still a sense of an American meritocracy?
Above all, what this debate has reinforced is how broken Washington is and how no one in Washington is really looking out for what's best for this country. But when I go out and talk to voters all over the country, what strikes me more than anything else, the complaint that I hear in the exact same words, in the exact same sentiments, in the exact same outrage, no matter where I am in the country, is the growing gap between the wealthy and everyone else, the destruction of the American middle class, and the loss of the great American middle class that they believe built this country, particularly in the post-World War II period, when we became the economic superpower in the world. It was built on the great American middle class, which in turn was built upon education and innovation and investment and manufacturing jobs and all the things that have been lost, which have in turn created this great imbalance. And you hear that exact same story no matter if you go to Michigan and Ohio, or if you go to California, or if you go to Florida, you go anywhere in the country and talk, and you hear that same story from voters. There's absolutely no doubt. And the outrage and the frustration just keeps growing and growing, and there seems to be no outlet for them.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Carl Agnew.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Carl Agnew, who is the founding partner with Gerstein Agnew. He's conducted research for hundreds of political campaigns, including directing national research and message development for the Gore-Lieberman campaign. He also serves as senior advisor to Democracy Corps, a nonprofit advocacy group he helped found in 1999 with James Carville, Stan Greenberg, and Bob Shrum. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is One Time, One Night by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. I'll be back tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.